I thought this song might be a good fit for our conversation tonight. It's called Meet Me in the Woods by Lord Huron. Kind of an eerie mood to that song, and the title certainly fits. If you are listening to us tonight from your cabin in the woods, or you live up in the mountains and it's dark and spooky where you are, you might gonna go check the latch on the door because it gets spookier from here on out. We're talking with Dave Politis about his new book, Missing 411, focusing on hunters. And when we return, we'll pick up the story of Aaron Hedges, who was 38 years old when he went into the crazy mountains of Montana on a hunting trip and never came back. His boots are found one place. His vest and backpack are found 15 miles away. Did he walk that distance in his bare feet in the snow? Seems unlikely. Dave Politis picks up the story in just a moment. All right, Dave Politis, Aaron Hedges is the hunter who disappears. His boots are found in one place, his vest and backpack a long way away. What's the deal on that?
So the locations where all this were found were pretty identifiable. And I looked on a geological survey map, and it looks like it's just over 13 air miles point to point. One article said it was 15. I got it at 13. Now, if you talk about any kind of survival expert, to go through rugged mountains, it's never point to point. It's at least double, sometimes triple, because you're going up, down, sideways. And in this instance, in the middle of winter, chances are he's not going to be crossing creeks and rivers, so it makes it a longer trip. Well, they interviewed a corporal named Greg Todd, who was the head of the Sweetgrass County Search and Rescue. And they asked him, with what you have in front of you, what he thought might have happened. And the quote he gave was, "That is the million-dollar question." And that's all he'd say. Well, then they went to Lieutenant Alan Ronenberg of the Sweetgrass County Sheriff's Department. And in the Montana Pioneer Press of October 3rd, 2015, they asked him what he thought might have happened. And to quote him, he said, "Everything from he got turned around and got off the trail, got caught in the storm, passed away off the trail from hypothermia, to he's in Mexico somewhere, to UFOs got him. There's literally a full list," end of quote. Essentially, they have no idea. Because,
What's your
like
guess?
what you said, George, the idea that somebody's going to walk 15, 20 miles through the snow in the mountains in the middle of winter with no boots is ridiculous.
I mean, it sounds like he was picked up, or his stuff was picked up and dropped somewhere. Talk to me about the boots, because that pops up again and again. Footwear. I know there's a theory about hypothermia when it sets in, that some people react that way, that they take off their clothes or their boots, and even though it makes no sense.
There is that theory, but many of the stories I've documented, their clothes or their boots or their shoes are found so close to the place that the people were last seen that there was no time for hypothermia to set in. Or the weather wasn't such that hypothermia wouldn't have been a factor. So I don't care if it's hypothermia or not, I don't care if you're Superman or not, the idea that you're going to walk long distances in a frozen environment without boots on, it doesn't make sense. And then you take in the fact that the location where his items were found, the area around that was searched thoroughly. Well, again, that doesn't make sense either, because to make the trek and then make a decision to drop all your belongings right there, common sense doesn't follow. Now, at the location where they found his boots, they found a water bladder that he carried for drinking. And he left that there. Now, that wouldn't be something you'd want to leave behind. You'd want to take that with you if you were going to move. Well, yeah, and common sense would say, yeah, you always want to take your boots. So, a very, very odd set of circumstances. But if you read my prior books, you know that this shoe thing and sock thing comes up time and time again, and it doesn't make any sense at all.
Haven't there been, I'm trying to remember from maybe the first book, cases where the clothing is like stacked or folded, or it's just found in unusual positions, or I don't know if there have been cases where it's on the body and turned around or ill-fitting or anything like that, but that's something has messed with the clothing.
Well, there have been stories where a very, very small child, say 2 years old or younger, disappears, and they're found with their shirt on backwards, a piece of clothing on the wrong way, and the parents said, the child doesn't even know how to take their clothing off. So this is who did this? That was one of the questions. In the instance you're thinking about, there was an incident in Tennessee where a small scout disappeared, and they found him laying next to a tree with his pants down to his knees, frozen to death. But then in an adjacent river, in the middle of the river, they found all of his clothes stacked and folded on a rock.
Yeah, that's weird. And I'm trying to remember, I don't want to jump too far ahead in this book either, but one of the stories, the image that is stuck in my head more than anything from this book is a guy, I don't remember which case, I can look it up in my notes here, but of a guy who is found under some unusual circumstances and his feet were bloody down to the bone. He had not only taken his boots off, but his feet had just basically worn off. Do you remember which one that is?
Oh, yeah. Now, that was a very... A lot of times the readers will read my stories and they'll say, but what was the condition of the feet? And a lot of times the coroner's reports won't even mention it. So in the incident you're talking about, yeah, that was a very, very unusual set of circumstances that they actually did talk about it. In that case, a man was hunting with his friend, and he told his buddy that he was going to go off and find some water and bring it back to the camp. Well, he took off, and he never came back. And his buddy that night thought something was really strange because his friend knew that area like the back of his hand. And they started a giant search. And this happened in 1952 in September. His name was James Madison. It happened in the Nez Perce National Forest in Idaho, another Idaho case, 67 years old. And this happened 14 miles east of the Red River Ranger Station. Well, these guys wanted to get an early jump on their hunting, so they took off. Well, on 9/11 of 52, they established their camp. So James goes just a short hike, you know, it's a couple hundred yards to the creek to get some water. He doesn't return. His friend's yelling for him all night, can't find him. Next morning, still yelling for him, can't hear nothing, no response, no shots fired, nothing. So he goes to the ranger station to get help. Well, the rangers called the sheriff's deputies who brought in bloodhounds. Well, on September 16th, there were headlines in the Lewiston Morning Tribune. The headlines were, "Hounds Stymied in Search." Well, a scent trail wasn't found, and the tracks weren't located, leaving the area of the creek where they thought he was at. Now, on September 22nd, the Air Force flew the skies for 2 days, and they found nothing in that area. Now, the weird part about this is, it's one of those instances where searchers don't find anything, but somebody else does. Well, late in the afternoon on September 24th, so this would have been, you know, this happened on the 11th and the 24th, almost 2 weeks later, four hikers found something really strange in the Salmon River in a really remote section. Well, they found this man, James Madison. He was face down 20 feet from the shore in 18 inches of water, dead. Now, a September 26th article in the Lewiston Morning Tribune quoted, "Robertson said death was caused by exhaustion rather than drowning. Madison was clad in his underwear and t-shirt. He was barefoot, and the soles of his feet were worn to the bone." The article further stated that he was 15 miles from his camp. He had been dead 3 to 4 days. Now, I've told this story to many people I know, and nobody I know could walk on their feet if they were that badly damaged.
Man, down to the bone. What's about the timing of, so he'd been dead for 3 or 4 days. How long was he missing?
So he was missing for almost 2 weeks.
So he'd been alive out there for, wow, that's just
long time.
Really weird. You got a couple of cases from California And I know a lot of our listeners are in California, so maybe we'll go there. Luke Kuykendall is one. Man, there's a lot of weird stuff in this one.
Yeah, this one is a strange case. I'm back at September 16th, 1941, in a location called Balch, Balch Hill, and that's an area about 16 miles south of a place called Dinky Creek. And that's in an area just south of Yosemite National Park, the foothills east of Fresno, California. If you read my books, Dinky, Dinkey Creek comes up a lot as a place where people seem to vanish. Now, Luke was 65 years old. He was a banker in San Francisco. Always went to the same spot to hunt, always went with his same friends, a guy named E.R. Vedder and a guy named Earl Ray. And they went to this spot up by Balch Hill, and they always established their camp along with a handful of other people. Well, the first day that Luke went in there, he was staying in camp, and Vedder and Ray went out to hunt. Well, people knew that Luke had a heart condition, and so if he went out to hunt, he wouldn't go very far. But he was the guy who liked to just kind of keep the camp and make the food and kind of enjoy the outdoors, but not necessarily go out and seriously hunt. But he would go out and hunt. Well, as a short while, a few hours after these guys are gone, somebody comes running into camp saying that there's an incident out there and a hunter was shot and they needed help. Well, Luke says, "Hey, what do you need me to do?" Well, they said, "Hey, just stay here. We're going to go get some help. And if the other people in the woods come in, you got to help them." He said, "No problem." Well, other people come back and they said, "We're going to go out. We're going to go help the people that were shot. And you stay close in here." Well, he walked partially out to about 200 yards down the trail from camp. And people said, "Luke, just stay right here. Keep an eye on the camp." He could see the camp from where he was at. And they said, "We'll be back in a few minutes." Well, they eventually came back. And what had happened was, is Vedder, his friend, had actually shot his other friend, Ray, thinking he was a deer, and killed the guy instantly. And they drug the guy into camp. And you imagine the chaos, you know, one friend shoots another, how emotional that would be. And now there's like 10 people in camp, and they're looking around, what's going on, and calling for help. And all of a sudden, everyone realized, where'd Luke go? Well, they searched around, called for him. Nothing. Well, Luke was the kind of guy, again, heart condition, couldn't walk far at all, you know, somewhat disabled. And Luke's sons heard about the incident the next day and immediately responded into the camp. They brought in rangers, sheriffs, huge search, questioned the kids about how far their dad could go, and they said, not far at all. And there was an article in the Fresno Bee. This happened September 16th. On October 1st, it said the searcher stated that Kuykendall apparently vanished at it as if he had sunk into the ground, no trace having been found. End of quotes. He was never found.
That's a heck of a quote.
Now, the part about this that we got to remember is that this guy wasn't a big, hairy, older, aggressive, in-shape hunter. He was, for all intents and purposes, disabled. He wasn't going far. How could we not find him?
The question of this incident where one hunter shot another, I get that from people who email me about this. They think that these explanations, in particular, before they read your book, before this book is even out, I'm already getting explanations. Well, that's what it is. It's hunters shooting other hunters accidentally and then hiding the body so they don't get in trouble for it. I'm sure that happens here and there, but it doesn't explain the cases that I'm reading here in this book.
No. And there would still be blood. There would still be a drag trail. If you're going to bury somebody, actually, the body still emits gases and things, and you could, you know, canines
Dogs would
still.
find it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if you think about that case I just told you, which is only probably 30 miles, 40 miles away from Yosemite, just outside the national park boundaries. That occurred in September 16th, 1941. Fast forward almost 2 years to July 18th, 1943, and a man named Emerson Holt inside Yosemite National Park. Now I'm going to tell you what happens here, and you it sounds so eerily similar, it's weird. So again, Emerson's 55 years old. He's from Riverside. He goes to Yosemite with a group of friends, and they're on the floor in Yosemite Valley. Super congested area. But the weird part about this is that a lot of people disappear on some of the main trails in that valley rather than in the back trails of the national park. His friends decide that they're going to hike to a place called Lake Merced. Well, the trail is like an improved large dirt road. It's an unmistakable path, and it's directly adjacent to the Merced River. Well, as the group neared Lake the location that they were headed at Lake Merced, Emerson tells his friends that he doesn't feel well. And he said that he wanted to stay right where he was, and he wasn't going to move because he didn't know if it was the altitude or whatever, but he just didn't feel right. Well, he wasn't in very good shape. He was somewhat disabled, and he goes, "I'm not going anywhere. You guys have fun." Well, his friends come back within an hour. He's not there. Well, the Merced River next to where he was only inches deep. It was barely flowing up there that year. Huge search. Nothing. And there were no deep pools. There was nothing in that area that would attract somebody or would hide a body. Well, there's a July 23rd UPI article that states, "Search parties today continue to look for Emerson Holt, 55, of Riverside, whose disappearance in Yosemite National Park Monday was considered, quote, almost supernatural, unquote, by Park Superintendent Frank Kittredge. Holt was never found."
Well, it's even more supernatural when you realize there had been another incident almost identical to it 2 years before. I mean, I can't imagine that the superintendent, if he had been there that long, wouldn't have remembered that one. You'd think.
Well, if they don't keep lists of people, who knows?
Yeah, that's right. Maybe they did back then.
Oh, I think they still do. What do you think, George?
I mean, I'm going to use the word, it's an abduction. I'm not saying who's doing the abducting, who or what, but that's what it sounds like. These are abductions. Is that too far afield?
Well, you know what's weird in my world is that every once in a while you catch an article where the national park person or the law enforcement person kind of puts their guard down and really says what they think, like Kittredge did there, something supernatural. And like the guy did on Hedges' case, you know, a UFO picked him up and took him. I think they say that stuff when they're not being protected, and they think when they're talking amongst friends, that's what they're saying.
I'll bet there's a lot of them that talk amongst themselves, your search and rescue folks who occasionally give you little glimpses into what they're saying to each other, whispering to each other, rather.
Oh, there's no doubt. And you know, every once in a while, I'll get an email from somebody saying, "Well, Dave, this is hard to believe that this case really happened because we've never heard about it." Well, I can almost guarantee that 99% of the cases in this book, people have never heard about them. But what's going to happen is all of a sudden there's going to be stories and in different venues about these incidents because they're so strange.
I'm curious whether you have any Park Service rangers coming forward since we've begun these conversations. We're going to go to a break here in a second. I'll let you think about that, how to answer it. But you know that there are some of those folks out there who have information. I'm sure a lot of them have explanations that they would like to. I'm going to set that Dave Politis straight. But I'll bet there's some stories that even you have not heard. When we come back, we're going to pick up these tales about the missing hunters, and there's some really good ones still to come. Stick around, everyone. Remember this band? They're called Wishbone Ash. The song is from 1980. The title is sort of what we're looking for, what we're seeking tonight. It's called Living Proof. The song Into the Break was John Fogerty in Mystic Highway. I had my nephew, who's 10 years old, Ethan, he visited me this weekend, and I started to tell him about Coast to Coast and the show that I sometimes host, and he stops me in the middle of a sentence. He already knows all about it. He listens to Coast to Coast. He's listening tonight, in fact, and I'm not sure that's a good idea because this is pretty creepy stuff, our conversation with Dave Politis about the missing 411 hunters. Still to come, the spookiest, weirdest case of all. Of all the books that Dave has written about these mysterious disappearances, this is the creepiest. The person involved did not, in fact, disappear, but encountered something and got a picture of it. And I think it is pointing us in a direction of at least a better understanding, if not absolute answers. So don't go away. That's still coming up here on Coast to Coast AM. A couple of years ago, when Dave Politis came to Las Vegas area to both investigate a couple of cases from this region and also to do some stuff with us for TV News, a series we put on the air, I got a chance to see him sort of in operation. A lot of these cases that are investigated, it's not as simple as going online and finding information, because they only get reported in tiny little newspapers and little regional areas, hometown papers that aren't necessarily online. A lot of these cases are old, so none of that stuff gets posted. Dave, talk about that for a second, the difficulty. I saw you here going through some pretty obscure little periodicals looking for leads in a couple of particular cases. It's painstaking work to track this stuff down, isn't it?
And, you know, sometimes I think those are the obstacles that are placed in front of us, and the powers to be know that. And I think if you're not adept at really maneuvering your way through the internet and having some phone etiquette to get people to help you in some of these small libraries in these corners of the state where no one visits, chances are you're not going to get much. But every once in a while, you'll get somebody on the phone who's very helpful, and, wow, we never even knew that happened, and they were never found, no. And there was a couple counties up in Montana where I actually got the sheriff on the phone, and explained to him, yeah, there was this case back in the late 50s, and I'm looking for information about it. He goes, wow. He goes, I've never heard of it. And then one of his deputy sheriffs called like a couple days later and goes, you're right, we never did find that person, and we don't even have a file on him. He goes, how embarrassing is that? And so this happens a lot. There's a case in this book about a small boy who was hunting with his family in Washington and disappeared. And I got maybe 8 or 10 articles about it, and I called the sheriff there. I got a hold of their records, and they said, well, we don't have anything. And they just wanted to slough it off. And I said, well, this boy was never found. And they said, well, we can't do anything. So I finally call the assistant sheriff, and he goes, really? And he goes, let me go see what I could find. And he calls me back a week later, and he goes, unbelievably, in 2 warehouses, we had archived microfiche. And he goes, we have it. And they sent me the entire case file, and it was one of the most bizarre things I've ever read. But he was apologetic. And a lot of these jurisdictions, if a case is 5 years old or older, they just dump it. And many people don't know that there's a classification, missing, presumed dead, that the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service use a lot. And this is the way for them to clean their records and not say, well, we don't have any missing people there. Oh, it's because they were presumed dead. So we don't have that report anymore, and they're just gone. So many of the cases that I write about, you're not going to find them in any database. You're not going to find them anywhere, and people have just forgotten about them. And it's a sad state, and every once in a while, family members will get a hold of you and say, well, thanks for at least trying to resurrect this, because nobody even wants to talk about it.
It's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, you have those cases where they find a technicality as a way to say it's closed or it's no longer active, or they say, oh yeah, that's an open case, we can't give you the records.
Yeah, that is so funny you said that, because I would say, depending on the jurisdiction and depending on the circumstance, I hear that maybe 40% of the time, 60% of the time, if the case is an older one, it's like they've lost interest in it and they'll give it to you. But a lot of times they won't. And the unusual part of that is that a missing persons case is one of the only things in law enforcement that they investigate that isn't criminal. Because a missing person still hasn't been classified as a homicide or a kidnapping, they're missing. And it's not against the law to go missing. And if George Knapp wants to just fall out of society and not show up to work one day,
but which is, by the way, I have that feeling often.
Yeah, well, that's what we're worried about, George. But you're not committing a crime. It may be immoral, and you may be not meeting financial responsibilities, but nothing criminal. And so a lot of times law enforcement loses interest in those rather rapidly. And unless there's something else that tweaks it, very little investigations ever done.
Just a quick comment, and then we'll go back to some questions I had in mind about librarians. You know, before the internet was so big, that was not your first stop. When you'd be working on a case that has some history involved, you had to check the newspaper archives or indices. The library would often be the first stop. And I've found librarians to be an incredible resource. They want to be asked to help with stuff. They love a challenge. And I'm sure you've experienced the same thing. I wanted to ask about Park Service folks, though. Before the break, I'm sure you get a range of different reactions from them. Retired folks, some people who want to give you information but can't. I know from seeing the film, which we'll be talking to your son Ben about later, that there are some folks who've been on the inside who do talk to you and help try to resolve this. In general, have you had some help, some people come forward since the project began a few years ago?
You know, sometimes just dumb luck, you fall into things. And I was with a friend of mine, and we were up at Rocky Mountain National Park, and we're on one of the main trailheads that go up to Long's Peak, and they have this little hut there and a little tiny National Park Service office. And I'd never been there, so we walked up there, and there's these four or five older guys that are sitting inside this employee hut talking, and they're kind of talking openly about work, and you could tell that they were all current or former National Park Service employees, and they were talking about interesting stuff. And so I told my friend, I said, hey, we're going to wait right here, because one of these guys, whoever the first one to leave, I'm going to talk to him. Eventually, one of these guys gets up and he walks out to the parking lot, and I stop him, I introduce myself, and said, I'm a retired law enforcement guy, and I've been investigating missing people in national parks, and this is kind of what I've been faced with. And he's all ears. He's like, Mr. Polite. And he goes, yeah, Dave. He says, I know what you're talking about. And I said, why would they be doing this? And I said, and you know, you obviously used to work here or something, because I could tell you're a former employee. He goes, I'm a retired National Park Service special agent. And that's like hitting a gold mine. And he was super nice. He says, Dave, I hate to tell you this because it's embarrassing, but it's a complete lack of integrity in the National Park Service law enforcement branch. And he says, I was faced with it for an entire career. He told us at one point he was making a case against the National Park Superintendent for theft, and he was told by his powers to be that they were told to just drop it and forget it. He goes, that kind of told me that there's no integrity here. And super nice man, answered all my questions, but that was probably the biggest gold mine I ever hit. Because, well, in the movie, in one of the segments that we had filmed, and we didn't use it in the movie, it involved a park where a family lost their dad. And one of the people at the park said, yeah, you want to go talk to this former park employee. And it was a National Park Service ranger that had left. And he was another gold mine for telling us the ins and outs of the National Park Service and how, in his mind, how corrupt it was and how they didn't do the right thing when they needed to do the right thing. And he says, eventually, I had to leave because my morals would be compromised by doing what they wanted me to do. And there was another instance in that same segment where the National Park Service told us to talk to this one ranger. He was going to be the point person for this interview about this missing person. This guy was the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. And we got him alone. And he says, hey, we know you know more. And we know you were told not to talk. And he's like hiding his face. And he goes, I was told not to talk to you guys. And he goes, I got to be really careful. Otherwise, I could lose my job. And I said, well, what's the truth? Why isn't the superintendent coming out of his office to talk to the victim's family about what's being done on the missing person? Nobody will come out and talk to the victim's family. He goes, it's an embarrassment, isn't it? I go, yeah. He goes, I'm supposed to be the front person, but I can't even talk to you about it. He goes, I can only tell you exactly what they told me I could say. And, you know, from that conversation, somebody way, way up in the National Park Service is pulling the strings on this. And that was the consensus of the entire film crew there, that the people at that park had no control over what they were doing. And going way back to an incident at in the Smoky Mountains National Park, where we interviewed the father of a missing person, he told us back then, he says, you know, the superintendent of a park is just a figurehead. Somebody way, way up is telling that person exactly what to do all the time. And he goes, in 6 weeks working around that man, I could tell he could never make a decision. He always had to call and get direction. So in some ways, the people that you meet are probably some of the nicest people you'll ever meet, especially the people on the trail that you meet that are the rangers. They don't know what's going on. But once you get down into the minutiae and you see that there really is something, some lacking of integrity on these things, and it's just not one incident. There's time after time where you meet these people, these victims, where they've lost a loved one. It's like the National Park Service does not give a darn about them and isn't embarrassed about showing it either.
Well, I think that's fair to say about certain levels of the hierarchy because you've run into it so often and it's well documented. I do think that there are people of integrity in the National Park Service. In fact, I know that there is a special investigator, somebody that you would classify as a goldmine, listening tonight and trying to make up his mind about whether he buys this scenario or not. And I don't want you to discourage people, make them so mad by painting them with a broad brush that those who might be on the fence about wanting to help would go the other way. I this a lot better than I do, but let me ask about a couple of other cases. And then at the top of the hour, I want to get into the one I hinted about, the really strange one that there's a photo involved. I should also say it involves one of the best-known luminaries in the UFO world, but if that isn't enough of a tease, I don't know what would be. There was a case in 1993, Red Rock Reservoir, a guy named Jeremiah Harris. You remember that one? And I think that's kind of an example where there a case that just gets no publicity at all or hardly any, but that's about to change.
Hey, that was a complete fluke. I found this in. It was buried deep, 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 so no one could ever find it. And in fact, there were some articles written that seemed to gloss over the main facts behind the case. But December 4th, 93, Jeremiah Harris, 18 years old, went deer hunting with a series of friends, Red Rock Reservoir in Knoxville, Iowa. Well, the group left real early in the morning. They get near the reservoir, and they decide to split up and hunt in pairs. As is the case in many of these, somehow or another, they got separated. And Jeremiah's partner couldn't find him. Well, later in the day, when the group decided to meet up at the cars, Jeremiah never showed up, so his friends contacted the Madison County Sheriff. Well, the search formally got started the next morning. And there were bloodhounds that were brought into the scene and planes searched from the air. Ground searchers just absolutely covered the landscape. And his parents, everyone's parents, were just searching to no end, trying to find out what happened to the young guy. Well, the search ended the first day with the dogs not finding a scent, and the other efforts, the planes and the ground teams, not finding anything. Well, Tuesday morning, a deputy was searching a farm that was searched the previous day from the air and on the ground. And they were just going over the same area before they started to expand the perimeter. Well, there was an article December 7th, 3 days later, in a newspaper called the Daily Reporter. And this is what it said. The body was near a brush pile not far from the pond. And that's all the facts that article said. And I read it, and I thought, okay, nothing here. It sounds like a mundane death, kind of strange. Another article the same day in the Oskaloosa Herald had quite an amazing story, quite different than that. And it says, hunter dies of exposure. Then it goes on to say, Dr. Gordon Arnott Sr., county coroner, said it appears the man tried to cross a partially ice-covered pond at night and became soaked. Harris got back to land and took off his clothes to dry and crawled into a tree where he died. Searchers found him here this morning. He just died of exposure, apparently, Arnott said. Now, let's go back to that again. So, he supposedly falls in a pond. He gets out of the pond on this farm's property. And in the middle of the night, he takes off his clothes and crawls into a tree where he dies. Logic there? He was wearing an orange hunting vest, and that was found on the ground next to the tree and the pond. So if he's wearing the orange hunting vest and that's seen, why wasn't it seen from the air when they were doing the flyovers? And if he was on a farm, why didn't he go into the farmer and get assistance? Now, you would think that the clothes would dry faster if they were hanging from the tree. And you got to remember, it was December. There were no leaves in the tree.
Yeah, on a farm. I mean, does this farm have a barn?
Exactly. Exactly.
And didn't you have, there's another one, another incident that you had written about before, sort of a coincidence involving a farmer?
Well, you know what's weird about this is just 8 miles from where this incident happened, I wrote in another book about a farmer who disappeared and was never found. And you think about the size of the United States, just 8 miles away? I looked at this and I said, I recognize this city. And I looked it up and I said, wow. But even a stranger coincidence is, as I'm researching this case and running the name Jeremiah Harris through various databases, this is bizarre. I get an archive search and I find that another Jeremiah Harris died on the same day, December 7th, 93, in Fort Collins, Colorado. And in that incident, that Jeremiah Harris was with another 16-year-old friend, and he was found dead in a creek. I'm scratching my head going, how many Jeremiah Harrises can there be?
Who die on the same day.
Yeah.
That's really creepy. I mean, that's a really creepy coincidence. I don't know. Synchronicity? I don't know. I don't even know what they call that.
Yeah, I saw that, and I thought, I had to read it three times before I finally understood how much parallel there was there.
In the next segment, on the other side of the break, I want to get into this mega case, this very, very weird case. It's one that you use to sort of close this book and kind of leave people with their jaws dropped. Before that, you know, there's a list of things that you tell people. We got about 2 minutes before we go to a break. There's a list of things that you tell people, advise them if they're going to Yosemite, if they're going out into the woods, that they should do. Why don't we go over some of that right now before I forget to ask you about it, because you'll be here for one more hour.
So the first thing is you got to tell somebody that you trust where you're going and when you're coming back. And when you come out, you're going to call this person and tell them you're okay. And it's got to be somebody you trust. So if you don't come back, they're going to call authorities. Check the weather before you leave. That's a key point. Carry a GPS trail device and a hard copy of the map. Carry extra water and energy bars, obviously. Carry a real cheap plastic whistle. Doesn't have to be expensive. I personally carry a satellite phone every time I go into the woods. And I also carry an emergency locator beacon. And what that is that when I activate it, it sends a message up to a satellite, goes into NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, that somebody needs help, and they dispatch search and rescue. Those things cost between $150 and $300. If you're a hunter, I would say 95% of the cases in this book would probably be solved and you'd be found if you carried one of these devices. If you want to be macho and you don't want to tell anybody, put it in your backpack, don't tell anybody. Carry an emergency blanket with you all the time, an orange, bright orange one, about the size of a cell phone. Firearms, if you're going into the woods and you're hunting, you ought to be carrying extra rounds. Amazing how many hunters don't know an international distress signal is firing 3 rounds into the air.
I'll tell you what, the song is telling us we need to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about cell phones, whether that's any help at all, whether any of these people who got snatched had cell phones with them. We're talking with Dave Politis in a moment. We get into a really, really weird case. Eagles, Victim of Love, take us into the break.